All right, at this time, it gives me great pleasure to introduce a good buddy of mine. This is Larry.
My name's Larry, and I am an alcoholic.
Hey, Larry!
And Al, thanks for inviting me, and welcome to newcomers. Hope you keep coming back. Hope you find what I found from this program. I'll go back to the beginning. I was the eldest of seven children of a very Catholic family. My parents were involved in the church, and I didn't see any value in being at Mass every Sunday. There were things that I would rather be doing. And this was with me always from the time I can remember. By the time I got to third grade, I was in public school at the time. It was time for me to start catechism classes and learning all about the church so I could do my first communion and my confirmation. Well, it was a couple of miles from my house where I had to walk to go to these classes. And after 3 months, my parents discovered that I never went to one. There was baseball games to be played, fishing to be done down at the creek, sports to be made. There was endless things to do rather than me going in and learning about religion. That just wasn't my kind of thing. So what that got me was fourth grade, I was in Catholic school. I was in Catholic school in Martinez, California, up in Bay Area. And it was a great school. I was taught fencing by the fencing champion of Europe. My baseball coach was Vince DiMaggio. It was a wonderful school. But every day was a religion. Every day, and God. And to me, I couldn't see how there was this mythical creature that was taking care of everything. My brain runs to math and science and logic and reason, and there was nothing logical or reasonable that I could find. I couldn't see God. I couldn't talk to him. I couldn't listen to him. I couldn't hear him. Nothing. So I just never, ever believed in God. And that's pretty miserable. Spending all your time in church, spending religion classes every day and not getting it. Just can't get it and really don't care to. I had no desire to come to any kind of relationship with the higher power. I didn't see where it would do any good. So, as a good Catholic kid, I would go to confession and do my penance, so I know all the prayers. Now, I know religion because I'm learning about it every day. I got a mountain of religion, but none spirituality, and I don't know the difference between the two of them. And that's the way it was. And we moved from there, and we came here in 64. But at one point, I thought, to please my father, I would become an altar boy. And because my father and I were totally different, but I thought this would please him. So I became an altar boy, and the Mass was in Latin. And the only thing I got out of that was when I'm setting up the crucibles before Mass, when I got that wine bottle in my hand, and there's no way you should take that, boom, down it went. And to this day, I remember that feeling going down my throat. It didn't taste good, but I remember that feeling. And Mass seemed to go just a little bit better. And it was something that I never forgot. And because for me growing up, I was naturally shy and introverted, fear of failure, inferiority complexes, never thought I was good enough, and even that little bit of wine, things felt a little bit different. And as time went on, we moved here, and just my luck, St. Joseph's High School opened up that year and had the first class, so I'm back in Catholic schools again. And I hated, I was, as a junior in high school, I was the smallest kid in school, and I was picked on a lot. And I learned that if whatever you say can and will be used against you, it's better to keep your mouth shut and let people think you're a fool than open your mouth and prove it. People were mean, I didn't like them, I didn't want to be around them. And I had a couple of friends, but they kind of thought like I did. And I did a lot of things other than sports by myself. I just wanted to be by myself. And, you know, I was always hunting, always fishing, camping when I could. I was licensed by the state of California to practice falconry, which is pretty hard to do, but that is a solitary thing to be doing, and that's what I did. And I didn't like high school until high school graduation. And high school graduation was my first drunk, and I got into that, and that was the magic, man. I could fit in with people, I could talk to people, I could enjoy being around people, and I could even talk to the girls. This stuff was magic, and I loved it from the very beginning. And from the very beginning, I always drank more than everybody else. For the next couple of years, going to junior college, I was majoring in partying and hunting and fishing, and my studies suffered. I did just enough to get through, just enough to pass, because if you didn't, you were going to get drafted. This was during Vietnam, and I didn't want to get drafted, so I had to at least maintain. And my drinking was controlled by having someone old enough to buy and having money in my pocket to buy it. And when I found that person, no matter what I got, I drank it all. Me and my buddies went camping. We're probably 19. And I drank a six-pack of Powerful 45s and a quart and a half of Ripple on top of it. And I was sick as a dog. I didn't get sick, but this time I did. I knew it was the wine. So from that point on, wine was out. I never drank wine again. Drank everything else, but not wine. And as things happened, I applied to a four-year college, but I was late because I was too busy partying than to do the paperwork and send it in. And so I was going to get drafted. And in fact, on Christmas Eve, I got notice in the mail to report for my pre-induction physical. I went down to the Air Force and I took their tests. And under their grading system, the four categories, I graded in the upper of every one, which I thought was wrong because I'm not smart enough to do that. And but they says, you come in the Air Force, you can pick any field you want to go into. And through my hunting and fishing days, I knew how to shoot. And they figured that out real quick. And I knew I'd be waist deep in rice paddies, so I picked administration. And I was sent into accounting and finance. And hated office work. I'm an outside guy, man. I do not like this. Did not like the military. Did not like being told what to do, when to do it, and how to do it. The military and I didn't get along real well. And The thing about the military was I could go on base and I could buy beer anytime I wanted. As long as I had money, I could buy beer. And from that point, I was pretty much a daily drinker. You know, not much to begin with, but pretty much every day. And, you know, two became three, became four in time. And I got out of the military in 1971. And I went to work in the oil fields here in Santa Maria. Back then, oil fields were booming here. And I was married now, and my father-in-law had a trucking company. And instead of going back to school and studying what I wanted to study, I felt it my responsibility to go to work, because I'd had a lot of responsibility with my siblings, which particularly when mom would go through depressions, and so I was doing a lot for my siblings. I was used to responsibility. That was my responsibility, go to work. Now, this company I worked for, I hated the oil fields, did not like it, but everybody drank. You know, I fit right in with the oil fields. And eventually, I moved into management of that company. And in the oil fields, in the 1970s, you did business with alcohol. That's just the way it was. I mean, gifts were alcohol. You went to lunch, you went to dinner. I would go to rigs in the evening time, and the purchasers of those rigs would expect me to have alcohol with me. And I did, and I was drinking it. I was drinking it just as fast as I could. But I wasn't getting in trouble. I wasn't getting in any kind of trouble yet. And in 1981, I got divorced, and I didn't see working for my ex-father-in-law was going to be the best thing to do. So I went to work running a trucking company in construction. And believe it or not, construction's full of drinkers too. You know, I find my people. You know, we just gravitate together. And for the first time in my life, my custody with my son, who was born in 75, was based on my work schedule from the oil field, which was 12 days on and 2 days off. So every other weekend I had my son, which my son was born October 7th, 1975. He was a twin and I lost his brother. Now, what kind of God does this? This is another thing why I'm just not going to believe in God, because what kind of God does something like that? What kind of loving God does that? What kind of loving God is supposed to love us and creates a flood that wipes out half civilization? That's a loving God? These are the things that weren't logical to me. So, in 81, when we got divorced and my son was with me only every other weekend, I was working regular hours. I wasn't working 100-hour weeks anymore. I was working 50-hour weeks. You know, Monday through Friday, 10 hours a day. Man, this is like playtime for me. And it was. I had no responsibilities. My drinking increased. It was like a slow, steady progress for 40 years is what my drinking was. And it was during the 80s that, it's just part of my story, I got involved with another issue. And it allowed me to stay up all night and drink. You know, that's what it was. And being an alcoholic, I began using that alcoholically too. That became basically an everyday issue. And I'm managing this trucking company. I've been managing it for like 6 years. And I'm really partying hard. And the owner of the company calls me into his office. And I'm thinking, well, this is it. It's finally caught up with me, you know. This is it. You're done, Larry. And I walk into his office, and he looks at me, he says, "You're a pretty smart kid. I just fired the manager of the rock plant. I want you to manage it too." And I'm thinking, man, all the stuff I'm doing is making me better. This is making me good. So I'm going to keep this up. And towards the late 80s, I could see the other stuff was killing me. Man, it was killing me. It was messing with my mind. And I was going to be dead soon. And so I decided, that's it, we're done. And this is, now I'm married my second time. And she wasn't willing to stop. And so she and I got divorced, but now I got two daughters out of this relationship. And we get divorced, and now I'm paying child support to two different women at the same time and alimony to one. And it's not getting in the way of my partying, though. You know, I'll do without, but I'm not doing without my partying. So I decided to quit the other issue. And man, I'll be honest, it was tough. It was difficult. It was white knuckle every single day, every minute of every day. The only thing I could think of was getting some more. But eventually, it got to be where, well, I didn't think about it yesterday. I didn't think about it for a week. You know, I kicked that. And what that told me was, as hard as it was, I could kick it. And I could kick cigarettes, and I could kick anything I set my mind to. If I set my mind to do it, I can do it. And so if I ever decide I want to quit drinking, I can quit drinking too. And that's what that told me. And I believed that when I wanted to, I could. Now, in the 80s, I'm also beginning to have issues with law enforcement, but nothing serious. I'm on Highway 154, headed to Santa Barbara, and I'm too drunk to drive, and I know I'm too drunk to drive, so I pull over, sleep it off, and I get the flashlight, wakes me up, and it's Santa Barbara County Sheriff's. And so I get out, and she was a cute little thing too, as I remember. In fact, at one point I asked her if she wanted to go out with me, like, this sheriff wants to go out with this drunken old cowboy, you know? And she says, "What are you doing here?" I said, "Ma'am, I decided I was too drunk to drive, so I quit." The upshot of that was, I got handcuffed and hauled to Santa Barbara, put in jail for observation, no tickets, no nothing, just observation. Me and a buddy of mine were barbecuing at his house. And we need more of that other issue. So we're going up to my house to get some more. And pulled over, Santa Barbara County Sheriff's, me and my buddy pulled over. And he separates us. And he says, "Do you have an open container?" And we've been drinking all day. And I said, "Yes, sir, I do. I have an open container in there." Now, by this time, my buddy, he's getting everything hidden. And he goes up and asks him, he says, "Give me the open containers." And he denies that there is any. And I told him, I said, "You ought to know me better. That if he asked me, I'm going to tell him the truth." And I was told everybody the truth, except when it came to my alcohol. I lied about my alcohol use. The upshot of that was, I got a ticket for allowing my passenger to have an open container, but not that I had one. See, I'm not getting any consequences for this. You know, I'm not paying the price for it. Our book tells us that our alcoholic life seems the only normal one. That's what this next little story is about. My second wife and I were in Santa Maria, met after work, and we're partying. Now, I don't know if this happens to anybody else, but we're partying and drinking and we get in an argument. You know, maybe it's just me, I don't know, but I think it's probably pretty common. So we get in an argument and we live in the Pomo, and we get up in the Pomo, and she says, I'm leaving you. I says, cool, that's fine. Take me back to Santa Maria so I can get my truck. She says, no, I'm going to strand you. I says, no, you can't strand me. She says, watch me. I said, no, you watch me, because you can't do this to me. You know, that's been the story of my life. Nobody is going to do that to me. So, a normie, he calls a taxi, he calls a buddy, goes in, sleeps it off. Nah, not this cowboy. I got back, I get my best night horse. And I bring him out, I saddle him up. And now it's a long ride back to Santa Maria from the Pomo, so six pack in one saddlebag and pistol in the other. And off I go. And I get, and I'm going down Main Street, and I'm amazed that Main Street between Santa Maria and Guadalupe, between midnight and 3 o'clock in the morning, no highway patrol, no sheriff, no city cops, no nothing. I'm scot-free, riding all the way in Santa Maria, right down Main Street. You know, and at this time, about the corner of Blosser and Main, there was a gun shop. It was Almond's gun shop, the old German guy, gunsmith, and I knew him pretty well. And it's foggy, it's 3 o'clock in the morning, and I'm on the south side of the street. And I see this car pull up to the gun shop. These four guys get out with a sledgehammer and break the big plain glass window on this gun shop. Man, I can't let these guys get a bunch of guns, a bunch of thieves like this. Pull out a pistol, I got a beer in my hand and the reins in my hand, and pull out a pistol like I'm riding up out of the fog in the middle of the night. These guys literally froze. You know, and their jaws open about this far. They must have thought they were seeing some kind of ghost or something. You know? But they're looking down up the business end of a 41 Magnum. And I think, they're not shooting at me. I don't want to shoot them. I'll just shoot the tires out so that to make it easy for the cops to catch them, because the alarms are going off. And at this point in my life, there's nothing good coming out of my brain. You know, I got no good ideas. But this voice comes into my head, and it says, Larry, how are you going to explain that you're drunk, horseback, on Main Street, Santa Maria, with a loaded pistol? And I decided, you know, maybe the better idea where I wanted to go was just a block around the corner. So I went around the corner. They had the yard, probably 10 acres. It was all cyclone fence through, and my horse got my pickup and went home. But the point is, I was not in a blackout. I was making conscious decisions every step of the way that this is just the way you do things. You know, it's insanity. Definitely insanity. And those were the kind of things that I was doing and getting into. Things like that were common. I spent, God, I can't imagine how many miles I've covered in the backcountry. You know, I love the wilderness, and I love my horses, and love my pack horse, and I love chasing cows and stuff too, but mostly I love the wilderness. And I had my favorite places. I'd go camp. And in each one of those places, before I left, I would make sure I had enough alcohol to get me back to the trailer, the horse trailer. And anything else I buried, because my next trip in, I might run short. And there's nothing scarier than running out of alcohol that far from the store. You know, that just can't happen. That would just tie my guts in a knot thinking about it. So I've got... there's alcohol stashed at the schoolhouse, Medulce, cottonwood. I got alcohol stashed all over the place. And what I had to get me back to the horse trailer was all I needed, because I always had a bottle stashed in the horse trailer in case I ran out before I got back to the horse trailer, so that could get me to town. So I always made sure I had enough to get me wherever it is I wanted to go. And the amount of time and energy I spent planning to get my alcohol, to hide my alcohol, where was I gonna put it? I had stash places everywhere, you know, everywhere. And that's the way my life is going. And I'm in the 90s now, and I am remarried. Now, she seems to think I drink too much, and she gets on my case about drinking. So what do? I get in a fight with her about my drinking. I load the horses, my saddle horse, my pack horse. I load up enough alcohol. I go to the hills for 3-4 days. I'm 55 years old and running away from home like a 5-year-old, because that's where my maturity is at this point. You know, the only thing that matters is my alcohol. And as you would have it, we got divorced too. For the record, I'm 4 times married, 4 times divorced. One marriage was in complete, total sobriety. So even sober, I make mistakes. You know, that's just life. And we learn. So in February, well, let me get back to in the 2000s, things are they're pretty much a mess. In 2006, my first grandchild is born over in Las Vegas from my oldest daughter. And man, first days off, I'm headed to Vegas. Me and a 12-pack and some vodka are headed to Vegas. And I get over there and see my little grandson. Wow, this is amazing. And my daughter looks at me and she says, "Dad, I can never let you babysit. I can never let you be with him alone." Wow, he's crushing me. Crushed me. It hurt me to the core. But was that enough to get me to quit drinking? No. No, even that hurt wasn't enough, you know? And by this time, I am making attempts to control my drinking and to not drink. I've got 1,000 attempts, you know, to control my drinking, to not drink. At one point, probably about 2004, I got a week. I white-knuckled a week. I thought, "You're good to go, man." Right back to drinking. That's what I did. And as it turns out, I make a serious attempt. I found a Bible, and I put my hand on that Bible, and I took a solemn oath that I would never drink again. And I meant it. At that time, I meant it just as much as I meant to take my next breath. But by the next day, you don't believe in God. That oath doesn't mean nothing. Right back to drinking. Right back at it again. And this is going on till I'm going to come up to the events of September 30th, 2007, my dad's 80th birthday. A beautiful 27-year-old daughter, the mother of my grandson, was killed in an auto accident. And for me, that was the absolute absolute proof that there is no God. Because by now, I know who I am. I know my exact words. I'll quote this to you. If there was a God, that beautiful young lady would still be here, and a worthless drunk like me would be gone. See, I knew who I was, and I knew what I was. And that put me into a pretty good spiral. Things were getting pretty bad. And so in February of 09, I have tried everything in the world to not drink and control my drinking. My wife at the time says, you go to AA, you try that. And she said, you get off the hard stuff, you can have a beer every once in a while. You know, I didn't understand my own disease at that time, nor did she. But to tell you the truth, that sounded perfect to me. If I could get off the hard stuff, just drink a beer every now and again, I thought that sounded perfect. I would be cool with that. And I can remember coming into these rooms, and I looked at those steps up on the wall. And by now, I know I'm powerless over alcohol. I discovered that. But I didn't see my life as unmanageable because my job, nobody at work knew I had a problem. Only the people closest to me knew I had a problem. My kids, my best friends, the friends of mine that I never saw anymore, they knew I had a problem. Work didn't know. My bills were paid, had a roof over my head. I was working every day. I didn't see my life as unmanageable. And come to believe that a power greater than ourselves could restore us to sanity. See, I thought, I saw that as, if you believe there's a power greater that can restore you to sanity, you are insane. You need something, because there's nothing out there. And turn my will over. You want me to turn my will and my life over to nothing? Absolutely nothing? Now, let's be honest. If I'd have turned my will and my life over to absolutely nothing, it would have been run better than the way I was running. And that's the truth. But I couldn't get those steps, and I couldn't see it. And my first men's meeting, the Tuesday night stag up to Mesa, these two guys follow me out to my pickup. And man, they're just talking and talking and talking. And I'm thinking, man, I wish these guys would shut up, because I kind of like to get a drink. And finally, the one guy says, would you want me to be your sponsor? I got no idea what a sponsor is or what a sponsor does. But I'm thinking, that sounds like somebody that's going to have authority over me. So no, I do not want a sponsor. But if I tell them yes, they'll leave me alone. And so, well, I had a sponsor right off the bat. Now, hard-headed old cowboy like me, I'm not going to talk to my sponsor. I'm not going to ask him questions. I'm not going to communicate with him. I'm not going to use my sponsor for what he's there for. And I'm reading the book, but I'm just reading it. I'm not really into it. I'm not digesting the book. And my drinking is curtailed, but it sure hasn't stopped. And my sponsor, who happened to be the secretary at the meditation meeting up at the Mesa at the time, he tells me, he says, I think you should go to the meditation meeting. I think that'll be good for you. Now, the wheels are going inside my head, and I'm pretty hard-headed, a little stubborn, pretty much a cowboy my whole life. And I'm thinking, meditation, this is a quote too. Meditation sounds like something a bunch of dope smoking hippies do up in a commune in the Redwoods someplace. And I never heard of no meditating cowboy, and I ain't the first. That was my exact attitude to prayer and meditation. That's the way it was. And that's the way my program was going at the time. So on July 17th, 2009. My life's a mess. It's a total mess. For the past few months, every morning I put my lunch together and I go to work. And the past few months, every morning when I'm putting my lunch together, I'm thinking, you can put a half pint in your lunch because you work alone. Nobody's going to know. You can get away with it. Now, at this point, what I'm doing for a living is I'm driving truck. And I am moving big, heavy, wide equipment. Sometimes going down the road 150,000 pounds, 42 tires on the ground, 15 feet high, 14 feet wide, and 100 feet long. That's what I'm doing for a living. And I'm actually entertaining the thought of taking a half pint in my lunch because I can get away with it. And by this time, I know everything that I said I would never do, I did. I knew I had lost control, and I knew the point in time was going to come when I was going to give in to that too. So on July 17th, 2009, I had an opportunity to explode my life, and I did it. I did it intentionally because I wanted sobriety that bad that I was going to ruin my reputation, my career, and everything to get sober. And a lot of people have been through it, and it doesn't affect them. For me, it was total pitiful, incomprehensible demoralization to a degree I couldn't imagine. And I'm just saying, Evan, I did what you guys told me. I got on my knees and I asked God. I says, God, I hope you're there. I hope I've been wrong all these years because I cannot do this. I need your help. I've been sober ever since. Since that day. And you know, I felt different. Now, I didn't know why I felt different, but things were different. I didn't know yet what it was. But it took me there to understand that the obsession was lifted. It was, I wasn't white knuckling and not drinking. I was happy, joyous, and free. I'd left King Alcohol behind. God had done for me what I could not do for myself. And that's the absolute truth. You know, this from a guy who didn't even believe in God. And so I go to work the next day and I start a new tradition. I climb up in the cab of that truck and I ask my guardian angel to ride shotgun, and I want God to be over my right shoulder. I don't tell the story a lot. I'm going to tell it today. And every morning I'm doing this. I'm 4 days sober. I'm not white knuckling it. It's a miracle. It's unbelievable to me. I'm driving down the road, and I'm going to 101 through Road Randy. And I have kind of like a Doubting Thomas moment. And I kind of looked over my right shoulder and says, God, you are there, aren't you? What happened at that very moment was that right shoulder, it got so warm and had a feeling that was incredible. I was afraid to look. I was afraid it was glowing. It was that not hot, but a wonderful warm feeling. And I got tears coming down my face. Get on the phone and I call my daughter and I said, Jess, I think I'm going crazy. And my daughter says, no, Dad, God does things like that. And so he does, you know. And I have a wonderful relationship with my children today because of AA. I have a great relationship with my higher power. I talk to him daily. As it turns out, I see my grandchildren all the time. When school was in Zoom, I had kindergarten and third grade going on at my house every day. You know? My granddaughters, who are now 6 and 10, come stay the night at my house. You know, I see my grandsons all the time. Who would ever thought, because of this program, I would be the most responsible grandparent? You know, I spend the most time with my grandkids, and I love it. It's miraculous. You know, in those final days, I used to think life sucks and then you die. That's how miserable this experience is. Just totally hopeless and miserable. And life don't suck and then you die. Life is good. You know, every morning, first thing I do, make a cup of coffee, go out on my back porch, and I say the third step prayer. I do that religiously every morning. And then I do a vision for you, because in that second paragraph of what we read from a vision for you, this first four sentences, it's a program in a nutshell. I do that every morning. And I talk with God religiously. That meditation that I thought, nah, ain't for guys like me. I secretaried that meeting for 8 years. I pray and meditate every day. And I love it. This program has given me a life that I don't deserve, and it's better than I ever hoped for. It's night and day, 180 degrees opposite from where I should be, you know? By now, I shouldn't even be here. But I am enjoying life. What on July 17th, 2009 was likely my forced retirement, I retired on my own time when I wanted to, almost 4 years ago now. You know, I was allowed to do that. I enjoy the responsibility. I enjoy doing things for others. I was 7 months sober, and I went to a lot of meetings. Every meeting I was going to, they were talking about service. So I'm thinking, man, I gotta get in service. How am I gonna get in service? I said, I gotta get this done. So within a week, as God would plan it, I'm secretary in the Napomo Foothills group on Mondays. And the Thursday night men's stag in Santa Maria, you know, boom, and I'm in service, and I'm doing this. And I'm with my sponsor, and I'm talking with my sponsor. We jumped into that fourth step, and I worked that hard, my fifth step, and I did this step. And those steps, that's who I found out who I am. You know, I'm not what other people said I was. I'm not what was put upon me. I discovered myself by doing those steps. Those steps that set me free every day of my life today is because of AA, you know? And it's good, and it's wonderful, and I love it. I absolutely love it. And I guess that's time, eh? Thank you.
All right, let's give Larry another hand.